Our first case for argument, United States v. Olivella and Crespo. Mr. Herbert.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Daniel Herbert, and it's my pleasure to represent Mario Olivella in this case, who is the appellant. Mario Olivella has sat in jail for the better part of the last year, and it's my firm belief that Mario Olivella was not guilty of the charges that were against him in the case at issue here today. Quite frankly, what happened in this case is that Mario Olivella, based on certain rulings, never stood a chance in front of this jury. The fact of the matter is that the facts in the case that was brought against Mario Olivella was so thin and so veiled with inconsistencies that the government did what it needed to do to strengthen its case. And what was done was unfair and was improper. And that is that there was extremely overwhelmingly prejudicial evidence that was entered, and my client suffered. He had no chance of receiving a fair trial after that was admitted. The fact of the matter is the evidence against Mario Olivella in this case, as your honors are well aware, this case stems from two separate conspiracies, one involving a zoning conspiracy, one involving a plumbing conspiracy. Mario Olivella was only involved with this plumbing conspiracy, had no connection whatsoever to the zoning conspiracy. The evidence may have been stronger in the zoning conspiracy, but it certainly was weak in the plumbing conspiracy, and specifically, it was weak against Mario Olivella. If I can lay out the direct evidence against Mario Olivella in this case for the plumbing evidence, it certainly is not overwhelming. As you will see, it was underwhelming. It was vague and it was incomplete. There was thousands of hours of phone calls that were interrupted via wiretaps. And out of those phone calls, there was several that were introduced at trial regarding Mario Olivella and the main player in this, who was a Benny Garniana. These are the phone calls that were chosen to be played, and these are the direct evidence against Mario Olivella. On December 14, 2007, Garniana calls Olivella, who was a plumbing inspector with the City of Chicago, about the pipes being needed to be replaced on the Granville property. Olivella's response is, when being informed by his friend Benny Garniata that the pipes had been installed by a non-licensed plumber, Olivella's response is, "That's not good. Those pipes need to be removed." The next instance in this conspiracy is December 18th, 4 days later, in which the government showed pictures of Mario Olivella at a Bulls game, a skybox, with Benny Garniata and a number of individuals. Again, nothing unusual about this based on the fact that it was clear at the...
How much does the ticket cost?
How much did the ticket cost?
Yeah.
That never came out into evidence, Your Honor, but I would submit that that it was a gift.
Bucks.
I'm sorry?
Probably $1,000.
I'm not sure. I would think now it would certainly be of more value considering the strength of the team compared in 2007. I do think that would play into the price of it. But nonetheless, the evidence was clear that these two were friends for a long time. The government's own witnesses provided that information. The significance of the Bulls game was that on the following day, 2 days later, Mario met with the Granville property owners. I'm sorry, he met at the Granville property, and he met with the licensed plumber, who was Benny Garniata and his plumber. The issue that was brought to Mario's attention prior to going to the Granville property on this day was that the only problem with the pipes was that an unlicensed plumber had installed them. Mario goes there on the 20th, does his inspection, finds out that there is, in fact, a licensed plumber, and then in his inspection, he puts that the pipes need to be reinstalled. They need to be ripped out, and then the final approval, once these pipes are ripped out, will be done by Chief Bathauer. That's Mario Olivella's involvement. Certainly not a benefit to Benny Garniana or anyone else for that matter. After that phone call, sometime later, after that meeting, the phone call, the biggest phone call out of the thousands of hours of phone calls that were intercepted via wiretap, the most damaging, the most relied upon phone call by the government was this phone call from Benny Garniana to a plumber, Vasil Foifu, where Garniana states...
What date is that?
It is it's the 20th of December, 2007. Garniana states, we agreed on a price. I don't really like the amount. You tell him it will cost him $7,000. That's how much he wants. No mention about Mario Olivella demanding this bribe money. No mention about, in order to have this work overlooked, it has to be a bribe paid to Mario Olivella or paid to somebody else. The next day, again, here's the evidence. Dimitri goes and pays his plumber, Benny Garniana, $7,000. The government captures that via photos. Later in the day, Benny Garniana and Mario Olivella have a phone conversation. Again, they've had many phone conversations. They've been friends for years. Mario Olivella agrees to go meet Benny Garniana at Benny Garniana's Northwest Side office. There's photos of this this meeting, or I should say there's photos of Mario arriving, and he went inside the office for 15 minutes, and then he came outside and drove away. That's it. No evidence of money exchanging hands. No evidence of an envelope being given. Nothing. Obviously, the government certainly inferred that this is where the bribe money was passed. But there is nothing else to suggest that.
What did Roman Sada have to say about him?
About Mario Olivella? She had quite a bit to say about him. It's important to note that she could say nothing about him with respect to the crime at issue, the crime in which he was charged. The only thing that, and I say only, I don't mean to minimize it because it was absolutely devastating for Mario Olivella's chances to succeed and get a not guilty in front of this jury. The only evidence that Catherine Roma Santa provided against Mario Olivella was information about a prior bribe that she passed to Mario Olivella on two previous dates, in which I plan on getting to that in a moment, but I can address it now if Your Honor prefers. It was completely it was inappropriate for Catherine Roma Santa to be allowed to testify to these prior bad acts of Mario Olivella, but nonetheless they were veiled in complete and utter inconsistencies. And it was just incomplete evidence that the government would never rely on at trial, but it was allowed to be brought in, and that, quite frankly, was what doomed Mario Olivella in this case. The fact of the matter is, if I can just finish very quickly with regard to the direct evidence against him, and I'll go right back to that point because it leads right into it. After this takes place, where this supposed bribe was paid to Mario Olivella, there's no other involvement with Mario Olivella. December 28th, 2007, the chief plumbing inspector goes out and inspects the property and determines that the pipes had been removed and signs off giving final approval. Mario Olivella never gave final approval. The chief plumbing inspector, Frank Bathauer, if the government's theory is to be is to be true, then Chief Bathauer obviously was lying about this inspection. And there's no evidence to suggest that Chief Bathauer was lying in any way. He testified in this case. He's never been charged.
Is there any bribe to anyone?
No, there's no bribe. With respect to Mario Olivella, there's no bribe.
For anybody?
There is a $7,000 payment by the owner of the Granville property, Dimitru Carescu, to Benny Garniana, but the government certainly believes that that's, or certainly propounded that that's a bribe. Quite frankly, I have no idea if it was a bribe. It never got to my client, Mario Olivella, but I think even looking at the facts, it's very hard-pressed to determine that that was a bribe, because Benny Garniana was the plumber for Dimitri Carescu, and work had been done. I mean, that's uncontested. There's evidence of the work being done. There is worksheets containing the times and the work that was done that the government had in their possession. There was subsequent testimony from the plumber that did the work and said the pipes were ripped out. Unfortunately, at Mario Olivella's trial, we could not get that plumber to come in. But the fact of the matter is the government had a FBI
sheet. What do you mean you couldn't get him? He couldn't be subpoenaed?
We subpoenaed him. We were unable to find him.
Oh.
So it was unfortunate. But in this case, the 404B, the character evidence against Mario Olivella, was extremely unfair and overly prejudicial, and it was, quite frankly, was improperly admitted. And moreover, with regard to the severance...
What would be the worst example of that?
Of the...
The most of that prior crimes evidence, yeah.
Well, quite simply, the prior crimes evidence that was admitted was evidence of three bribes that occurred... in previous years previous to the date at issue. There was a $9,000 bribe in 2004 related to a property in Sacramento. There was a $2,500 bribe in 2006 related to a property on Mango. And there was a $4,000 bribe with respect to a property on Sheridan. And one other issue is this $250 gift card that was also admitted as a prior bad act of Mario Olivella. And that was equally as damaging as the other three instances of bribes in this case. When I say it's damaging, it's clear that it was damaging for a number of reasons. This plumbing conspiracy, the fact of the matter is there was no evidence to suggest a bribe. And we know that because two separate juries have found anyone else related to this plumbing conspiracy. They've acquitted the individuals of that. With respect to Dimitri Carescu at our trial, they could not reach a verdict with respect to the plumbing conspiracy, but at a subsequent trial, they acquitted him of this. Mario Olivella, the jury stopped listening to the evidence. It's clear because they heard days and days of testimony that Mario Olivella should not have been involved with, and because the cases were joined improperly, the jury heard days and days of evidence that was in no shape, way, and form related to Mario Olivella that talked about Catherine Romasanta bribing 25 to 30 city officials and William Wellhausen. He testified about taking all these bribes. The jury had no other conclusion to make that Mario Olivella, as a city inspector, was involved in these bribes, despite what the evidence showed, because the evidence did not show anything that Mario Olivella accepted a bribe, demanded a bribe in any way.
Okay, thank you, Mr.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, I'm Leonard Goodman. I represent Dimitri Carescu. I'd like to begin, with the Court's permission, and focus on the first argument related to the false testimony of Ms. Romasanta. Mr. Carescu was an inexperienced developer who was attempting to renovate a vintage apartment building on the north side of Chicago on Granville Avenue. He had done one other similar project about a year earlier, renovating another north side vintage apartment building. That one was on Maplewood Avenue. Before the Maplewood project, Mr. Carescu had run a small remodeling business specializing in hardwood floors and kitchens. And before that, he had been a resident janitor for 10 years. According to his architect, he had no knowledge of the permitting process. On both of these projects, Maplewood and Granville, he added units to the garden or basement level, which was 3 to 5 feet below the ground. It was common during this time, 2005 through 2007, for developers to do this in vintage buildings, and the reason was, obviously, because you could sell anything at the time. He hired Catherine Roma Santa, who was referred to him by his architect, as a professional expediter to obtain his city approval and permits. When he called...
What was his understanding of what an expediter does?
I don't know that he had any understanding. The testimony was that on his first project, he asked the architect to draw the plans. He asked the architect to take the plans to City Hall. The architect told him they were rejected. You are going to need to call a professional expediter, and he gave her the name of Catherine.
Suggested a professional expediter rather than a lawyer?
Yes.
That sounds really fishy. Really fishy. If an agency rejects an application and it's important to you, you need a lawyer. Well, right? They presumably rejected it on some legal ground. An expediter sounds like a briber. What else could an expediter be?
Well, the testimony was, including from government agents, that an expediter is a legitimate profession.
What does this legitimate profession do?
They know City Hall.
Know City Hall, right. They know the people.
Pals. They know how to go to the different apartments.
They know
different
how to
departments.
Bribe them, right?
Well, no, Judge. Well, there's plenty of...
What is their relevant knowledge?
The relevant knowledge is they know. If you're an inexperienced expediter and you don't know anything about the permitting process, the testimony was Mr. Crespo had never even been to City Hall, and somebody says you need to get zoning approval, you need to get plumbing approval, you need to do this. You hire an expediter to take the plans. Pardon me?
You need a lawyer.
Well, certainly he would have been better served, but this is what he was told, and this is the undisputed testimony, Judge.
Are they still these expediters, or they've been driven out?
No, there still are expediters, Judge, and it's a profession, and it's a legitimate profession. Now I think there's tighter controls on it.
So if you get into an argument with the Internal Revenue Service, you hire an expediter?
There's professional expediters who help builders get permits at City Hall.
Why was it rejected?
It was rejected by zoning.
Why?
Well, the testimony was that it was rejected. Mr. Carescu believed on the first project that he had approval for the additional units. The architect, who's not a professional expediter, took it to City Hall. Zoning reviewed it and said denied. I don't think they gave a reason.
You didn't say that you can't. He wanted to get two more units, and that was.
No, it was four. The first project, he got four additional units.
All right, but I don't know about the. Is that project an issue before us?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And that was expedited as well.
Yes.
Okay, and then this one was just for two.
The second one was for two.
And so what was the evidence as far as getting the first one? Was there any?
The first one was introduced as 404B. It was not charged.
All right.
The evidence was that he hired, suggestion of his architect, he hired Catherine Roma Santa to get the permits.
So this is his second lap with Roma Santa then?
Yes.
Okay. So he's, it was, something was rejected.
It was rejected when the architect brought it in the first time.
Okay.
The architect said, call Catherine Roma Santa. I see her in City Hall. She knows how to get these things done. Here's her number. He calls her, and she gets it through.
And the problem was that he wanted to renovate the two basement apartments. And you can't do that. Isn't that what the problem was?
Well...
And so they had to change the plan so it looked like those two were already there.
In fact, and this is an important point, can you do it or can you not do it? It was quite common at that time, but there were legal ways to do it, and I think this is what is so frustrating about this case, is during June and July on the Granville project, Ms. Romestanta, who is now a government agent, she's wearing a wire, every single phone call on the second project is recorded, the charged conduct. Every single phone call is recorded, and never once, she engages Carrescu in extensive conversations about fees and costs and price. Never once do the agents have her, and during extensive face-to-face meetings, private meetings between the two of them, never once does she say, Mr. Carrescu, you know I'm going to have to pay a bribe in order to get this done. In which case, Mr. Carrescu could have either...
What did she tell him she was going to do?
She didn't tell him. She did not tell.
She had all these long conversations.
She said it's a two-step process. I have to go to two different departments. It's very difficult to meet through. We got to move fast. We have to move fast. The city isn't going to keep approving these. We have to move fast. That's what she told him. It's ambiguous language, and never once does she say to him, which she could have said, I'm going to have to pay a bribe, in which case Mr. Carrescu could have said, either that's fine, go ahead, I'm comfortable with that, or he could have said, no, I'm not comfortable with that, isn't there some other way? And then he would have presumably learned that you can hire a lawyer and get it rezoned, or you can do an administrative adjustment and duplex down and still build out the garden level, which is actually what ended up happening after he was arrested. They deconverted the building, and he ended up building duplexes. So the issue here is, in one of the early discussions and these extensive discussions about fees, Mr. Carrescu says to Ms. Romasanta, I believe, they're talking about the fees, said, I believe I gave you $4,000 per unit last time. And on direct examination, Ms. Romasanta tells the jury that he's referring to the bribe payment that I passed on to the inspector on the Maplewood project. Government counsel knew when it elicited this testimony that it was false or mistaken. As the lower court found, this was a retrial, and the correct information about the Maplewood project was all in the record at the first trial. Four units were added at Maplewood. Ms. Romasanta had claimed in her testimony and in interviews with agents that she had paid the zoning inspector an $8,000 bribe in order to get approval, which means that she paid him $2,000 a unit to approve the four extra units at Maplewood. Therefore, when Dimitri Carrescu said on the tape, I gave you $4,000 per unit last time, he was referring to the total fee that he paid her. He was not referring to any bribe payment. And this is critical because the whole issue was knowledge. The issue is not whether she paid a bribe or not. In fact, what apparently happened on the Maplewood project is she charged him $4,000 a unit, and she paid the inspector half of that money. The way that Ms. Romasanta explained her false testimony was to misremember the number of units on the Maplewood project. She said it was only two units, not four, that were added at Maplewood. Therefore, when Dimitri said, I gave you $4,000 last time, he's talking about the $8,000 that I paid the inspector. Two times four is eight. Government counsel fully exploited this false testimony, repeated it at least six times, used it to show knowledge that Catherine Romasanta that intended to pay bribes on the Granville project and that Dimitri knew that, because all of the negotiations on the Granville project were about price per unit. So the government said, incorrectly and falsely, repeatedly elicited testimony that all the discussions about price per unit were about bribe payments to the inspector. In fact, as the government knew, this was not correct. They were about the total fee that Mr. Carrescu expected to pay. The testimony was established that it was common for legitimate expediters, and this is testimony from government agents, it was common for legitimate expediters to charge a per-unit fee to developers who want to add units. The government used this testimony to false testimony to establish knowledge on the crime charged. In U.S. v. Freeman, this court set out a three-part test for when a new trial should be granted based on false testimony. Testimony has to be false, the government knew or should have known, and there's a likelihood that it would have affected the judgment. Here it was false. In its brief, the government engages in obfuscation. They suggest, well, it was she got the number of units wrong, but it wasn't really false because she did bribe the inspector on the Maplewood project, which is not a matter that is in dispute, whether she bribed the inspector or not. The issue was, when Mr. Carrasco is talking about price per unit, is he talking about a bribe payment that he wants her to pay, or is he talking about her fees? And the fact, the evidence is clear that he was talking about her fees. Second, the government knew that it was false. And again, the government argues in its brief, well, we really didn't focus on this until after cross-examination. Well, as the lower court found, the government had to have known that the testimony was false because there was a first trial when all of this information came out about the Maplewood project, the city records and permits, which showed that it was originally 8 and he added 4 to make a 12-unit building. They had the architectural drawings. They had interviewed the architect during the first trial, and the architect actually testified at the second trial. Also, the government's position now contradicts the position that they took at trial when government counsel stated on the record that he had no responsibility to correct this witness. Because what the government counsel said is that's the way she remembers it. She remembers it being 2 units. I can't tell her she's mistaken. If I may, if there's no questions on that, I would like to just point out that this cannot be harmless error, and this is basically what Judge Lefkoe said. And what Judge Lefkoe said is, well, she accepted the government's explanation that this was 404B evidence. But as the court will see from the record, and it's carefully laid out in the briefs, the government fully exploited this false testimony to prove the central issue in dispute. The central issue in dispute is whether Dimitru had knowledge. I see that my red light is on. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Hotelling?
May it please the Court, my name is Chris Hotelling, and I represent the United States in the Mario Olivella portion of this consolidated appeal. Counsel, during his portion of the argument, spent a considerable amount of time essentially arguing the sufficiency of the evidence and arguing before your honors that it was insufficient to rise to the level of guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. I have a good faith disagreement with Mr. Herbert, and I believe that the jury did as well. The jury considered all of the evidence, heard all of the evidence that arose from a number of different sources, wiretap conversations, surveillance performed by law enforcement officers, testimony provided by individuals who were on the scene, as well as phone records, and all of that evidence collectively rose to the level of the defendant's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. So I don't believe that the defendant has met his nearly, as this court has recognized, the nearly insurmountable hurdle of establishing that the evidence was insufficient to prove his guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, especially considering all inferences that need to be drawn in the government's favor. So turning next to a point that Mr. Herbert also raised in his brief is the 404B issue. The district court did not abuse its discretion when it permitted the introduction of 4 separate instances of prior bribe conduct that the defendant engaged in. The district court correctly concluded that Mr. Olivella's other bribe conduct was admissible to establish his intent for one of the specific intent crimes that it was an issue in this case, his knowledge, his planning, and his absence of mistake, all appropriate purposes under Rule 404B.
Were these any of these previous bribes to expediters?
The bribes, with respect to Ms. Roma Santa, testified she was acting as an expediter in those instances when she paid bribes to Mr. Olivella. So the Mango property and the Sacramento property, she was acting as an expediter, paying that bribe to Mr. Olivella directly in her capacity as a corrupt expediter. And then with respect to Tio Scorte, he was a developer owner of the property at Sheridan. He personally paid the money directly to Mr. Olivella, hand to hand. And then the fourth one dealt with the what we've referred to as the gift card list, a list that was maintained by Mr. Garniata in 2005, which listed during Christmas time a list of different building inspectors and other city employees to whom he intended to pay a gift card, a favor bank, a gratuity during the Christmas time period. And Mr. Olivella's name was referred to as Mario O on that document, and a price corresponding to a gift card amount written immediately to the right of his name.
And was it Olivella who got to sit in the skybox?
It was, Your Honor.
As Garniata's guest.
That is correct.
Do you know what that ticket was worth?
Judge, the only thing that we know for a fact is that there was a skybox. So it wasn't just a ticket either in the stands.
Very expensive, the skybox ticket.
I think Your Honor and this court can take judicial notice of the fact that, yes, skyboxes are very expensive.
This was Garniata's skybox.
This was Mr. Garniata's skybox.
What's he do?
Mr. Garniata was a developer. He was also a contractor. He owned a plumbing contracting company. He also owned an electrical contracting company.
He's supposedly a rich guy, I guess.
I think his business was lucrative and successful.
You're discussing him in the past tense, now.
His business is in the past tense. He was, as the record clearly shows, Mr. Garniata was charged as a co-conspirator in this case. He decided to plead guilty prior to going to trial and was sentenced to a term of imprisonment by Judge Lefkoe and is now out. In terms of that, yes, Judge, I am talking in the past tense because he's no longer engaged in that type of activity.
Is there such a thing as a legitimate expediter? Someone who knows their way around the courthouse and this and that. From a layman's standpoint,
sure.
To me that sounds presentable. Everybody doesn't have to be a lawyer. They do know their way around and know how to get things done without bribes, but knowing who to see and when to see them, and you get an inside track, you know what you're doing rather than the first time.
I didn't mean to cut you off. So and the answer is there is a legitimate profession that is recognized by City Hall as an expediter. At this time, in fact, expediters are regulated. They need to apply to City Hall. They need to be licensed.
Oh, now, you do now?
They now need to be licensed. It was not the case back in 2005, 2006, 2007. Many of these individuals don't have a lot of experience in the building trades, but nevertheless receive a certain amount of training from their employers.
I assume it's the expediters that got that law passed.
All excellent questions, Judge. all I can tell is that as a result of many of these prosecutions, City Hall made a decision that it was time to regulate expediters. That I can tell you. That is what happened. But going back to answer the question again to make sure I'm clear on it. There is a recognized industry that is expediting. Turning just again briefly, because I see my light is on, with respect to the joinder and the issues that Mr. Olivella raises with respect to joinder, the district court properly denied the pretrial misjoinder motion because the face of the indictment established that all the defendants participated in a common plan or scheme. And that a common plan or scheme that was characterized by Judge Lefkoe as the plan to expedite the Carescu's renovation of the Granville property.
But isn't the problem that they don't use the word bribe, and isn't it possible that a naive developer, maybe that's Carescu, well, I'm skipping over, but... I should postpone that to Carescu, but sorry to... But with regard to Olivella, what is the strongest evidence that he actually received, apart from the gift certificate, that he received actual cash?
The evidence comes from the wiretap conversations and the corresponding surveillance and the sequence of events that took place on December 20th, December 21st.
These are Roman Sanders?
No.
Who is wired?
And then it goes to there are two components. The person we actually had a wiretap that was on Benny Garniata's cell phone and his office phone.
Oh, okay.
By this point in time when the wiretaps were up, Ms. Roma Santa was no longer actively a part of the investigation. It had transferred then to where we were on a wiretap on Benny Garniata. It was one of those coincidences that just so happens that the individual that we had a wiretap on was the same individual that Mr. Carescu, as things were developing going forward on the building issues, reached out to in order to continue to further his efforts to secure bribes and to get the inspections that he needed to have done so that he could sell his units. So at the plumbing stage, it was a wiretap on Mr. Garniata's cell phones. And that's where the best evidence does come from. It's that conversation between Mr. Garniata and Vasily Fofiu, which immediately followed a face-to-face meeting between Mr. Olivella and Benny Garniata at the Granville property. So you have a surveilled meet at the scene of the property. 30 minutes later, Mr. Garniata is on the phone with a representative of Dimitri Carescu saying, I talked to him, I'm not happy with the number, but he told me that it would be $7,000 for the job. Now, as we establish and go through in our brief,
That he was referring to Olivella?
I think it was clear. Absolutely. I think it was clear, Judge. And I think, and we discuss kind of how that sequence of events runs through in our brief, how there was that conversation, then there was that immediate follow-up phone conversation. Later that day, actually it was the next day, there was a discussion about Mr. Carescu meeting with Benny Garniata and providing him with, in fact, $7,000 in cash at a Starbucks. And then shortly thereafter, there was a phone call between Mr. Garniata and Mario Olivella saying, come on over to my office. Mr. Olivella saying, I'm already at your office at like, I think it was like 5:30 or 5:45 at night. Mr. Olivella waiting outside anxiously for Mr. Garniata to arrive. And then there was a surveillance video of Mr. Olivella getting out of his car, going into Mr. Garniata's office, inside for approximately 15 minutes, coming outside of the office, getting Mr. Olivella getting back in his car and driving away. And then I think it's further established, and I'll just finish my last thought on that very same point. It's further established by what we actually know happened at the property. We had the testimony of Ken Turnquist, who is a business representative who did on-site visits at the Granville property and noticed that there were a number of pre-existing plumbing code violations that continuously were not corrected even after Mr. Olivella and his boss signed off on the building permit certifying that the plumbing was accurate. So I think when you put all of those facts together and all of that evidence combined together, clearly established Mr. Olivella's guilt with respect to the plumbing conspiracy. If there are no further questions, I would respectfully ask that this court affirm the conviction of Mr. Olivella.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Hotelli. Ms. Zindel?
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Stephanie Zimdahl, and I represent the United States. The district court did not abuse its discretion when it determined that the mistake in Roma Santa's testimony regarding the number of units added to the Maplewood property did not warrant a new trial. This mistake did not establish that Roma Santa's testimony regarding Carescu's knowing payment of bribes in connection with the Maplewood property could not have happened or that it was not indeed the case. Additionally, in any event, and as the district court found, there's no likelihood that this minor mistake in her testimony had an impact on the jury. The defense here today has said that what happened on Maplewood is that Carescu gave Roma Santa $16,000, and then she then passed on $8,000 to Valentino. And that's what the district court said as well. The district court said that given this minor mistake in Roma Santa's testimony, the jury could have still concluded that Carescu knew that a bribe was being paid on the Maplewood property, that the money he was giving to Roma Santa was in all or in part being passed on to Valentino.
What's the strongest evidence that he knew it was a bribe? Because, of course, his argument is that, you know, he was inexperienced and so on, new to the business, and He just gives the expediter whatever she asks for, and he doesn't have any idea what happens to the money.
First, there was Ms. Romasanta's testimony that she, in fact, told Mr. Carrescu that she would be passing on the money to Inspector Valentino in order to obtain additional units for the Maplewood property. There's also the conversations that occurred when they were talking about the Granville property, in which they're talking about the bribes that are going to be paid for the Granville property and referencing what they did last time. And Dimitri Carrescu says, I paid you $4,000 last time, and then they immediately flow into talking about how much are they going to pay to these guys on the Granville property. And that suggests that both in the Granville property instance and also with the Maplewood property, that they were indeed discussing bribes and not any sort of fee that Ms. Romasanta was going to collect. With the Granville property, which is the property that was charged in this particular case, in numerous conversations, Ms. Romasanta refers to these guys. If she's talking about her expediting fee, there's no guys that she needs to work that out with. And Dimitri Carrescu never says, who are you talking about? This is your fee. Instead, he responds and says, I can't imagine that they will go sky high. Talk to them and let me know. He is engaging in this conversation, clearly aware that she's negotiating with other people for what he needs to pay. Additionally,
well,
when they're talking...
Ms. Zendel, you're working with Ms. Romasanta, right?
Yes, she is the witness that testified
in
this trial.
Well, give us an estimate of the number of conversations or in hours of duration that you have taped in this case.
You know, I believe there was a binder about that thick of transcripts,
right,
just to give you sort of a visual.
Do you think in one of those the government might have proposed to her that she actually used the word bribe? Especially since you had a situation in Maplewood. I mean, you know, I'm not saying you want to structure all the conversations, but wouldn't a prosecutor look to cement the inferences you ask us to take in this case?
Your Honor, I don't dispute that that was something that possibly could have been done. However, in this case, and as Ms. Romasanta testified, she was going forward and engaging with her client, Dimitri Carrescu, as she normally would.
Normally, meaning she had one prior experience.
Right, and how she dealt with other individuals. Ms. Romasanta testified that she paid approximately $187,000 in bribes to between 25 and 30 employees over the course of her time.
She testified at trial to that effect.
She did, Your
Honor. Did she ever mention that that's what she had spent over the period of her career to Mr. Krzyzewski?
I don't believe that's in the record that she did mention that to him, at least in the course of the recorded conversations, and she never testified to that effect. However, in the conversations that she has with Mr. Carrescu, they're repeatedly talking, again, about negotiating these payments.
Oh, I appreciate this, the guys, and I assume she doesn't mean fellow expediters.
Correct, Your Honor.
I don't want to be dismissive the inference you asked us to draw. It just seems to me over such a protracted period of time with someone that's wearing the wire for the government, you might want to have drawn that out. My other inquiry is, Mr. Goodman points out, and it's clear, that Romasanta's testimony seems to be an error. That knowledge was in the government after the first trial. And I assume you talked to her before the second trial, or I don't know if you were the prosecutor, but the government wants to talk to her before the second trial.
Your Honor,
why wouldn't you want to correct that?
The government is not contesting that it knew or should have known as a result of documents that were in its possession. However, the documents that were brought to light at the first trial, not introduced into evidence, but actually brought up and brought into issue in the first trial, were documents that were of the sort, of the very nature that is embodied in this fraud. This fraud was all about creating false documentation that the number of dwelling units pre-existing at a building were in fact larger or different than what they should have been. So it's not surprising that the government actually viewed these documents initially with some level of suspicion and wasn't sort of taking them at their face value to truly represent what they said on them. The easy permit, for example, said 8 units, but there was no independent verification that that was indeed correct. And the architectural drawings that were produced by Zifang, who was the architect on the Maplewood case, in fact actually state on the top 12 dwelling units. They represent that there were 12 existing dwelling units. And we, that was certainly not the case because that's what the bribes on Maplewood were being paid for. So these documents were simply just not as clear as they now appear in hindsight. And that after the second trial and after the testimony of the architect who stated that he went into the building and it was empty in the basement and that there were no units there, the government had decided that it was appropriate at that time and that it was clear that then there were an addition of 4 units. And it has conceded that point. But that's sort of why it did not.
What do you mean by an additional 4 units? I don't.
On the Maplewood property, there was an 8-unit building, and Demetri Crescu wanted to develop an additional 4 units in the basement, and that is the bribe that was paid on Maplewood, was to obtain additional units, a zoning approval for those additional units. Correct, Your Honor. Ms. Romasana testified that the $4,000 per unit that she and Demetri Crescu were discussing was a $4,000 bribe she paid per unit to get additional units added to the Maplewood property. She had testified at trial that it was 2. It now appears from documentary evidence and the testimony of an architect involved that there were actually 4 units added to the property instead of 2.
So she was just...
She was mistaken as to the number of units that she recalled having added to the property.
How much would that affect the
$8,000? She recalled...
Pay $16,000 because there. I mean, would she demand $16,000?
It certainly likely would have impacted the total amount she received. And in fact, Mr. Crescu testified in his first trial and has asserted in post-trial motions after the retrial that he in fact gave.
So the notion that if it were 4 units, $8,000 might actually be her fee rather than a bribe. Is that the idea?
That is
certainly just $2,000 a unit.
That's certainly what defense counsel has said today, that there was $16,000 given to her, and that's what Mr. Crescu has said in the past, and that she then passed on only part of it. Her recollection was that she had passed on the $4,000 as a bribe, but as the district court found and did not abuse its discretion in so finding, the jury could have taken from this testimony that he well knew that money was being passed on as a bribe in connection with the Maplewood property, even though she misremembered the detail of how many units were actually added. Mm-hmm. Additionally, Your Honor, the district court really focused on and held that this mistake did not affect the judgment of the jury. And that's because there was substantial evidence that proved the conspiracy to bribe for the Maplewood property. There is, as I've mentioned numerous times, the conversations about working out the amount with these guys. And additionally, there's numerous times during a July 10th meeting when Ms. Romasanta, after they discuss how much they're going to pay these guys, she says, and then my expedite, or and then I'll let you know what my expediting fee is going to be. And Mr. Crescu never says, wait a minute, we just agreed on your expediting fee. What are you talking about? Instead, they continue discussing their plans, and he offers to refer her to another individual in lieu of an expediting fee.
Did she testify and basically translate some of the recordings?
Yes, Your Honor. She testified to the jury what her understanding was at the time that she heard things on, heard statements from Crescu and others, as well as to what she was intending to mean, what she meant when she said certain things. And this was testimony that the judge below found to be proper under Federal Rule of Evidence 701.
Yeah, but see, that by then, of course, she probably talks about bribes, literally.
She did. Her testimony
as opposed
was.
To, as Judge Flom asked, why. Did it occur to her to sort of mention bribe while she's being taped? Is she so locked into her normal conversations that she didn't want to, she was afraid she'd tip somebody off by saying bribe?
I don't believe the evidence suggests that that is the case, Your Honor. I believe that she said that she was just speaking as she normally would in these situations. Much like a drug dealer might not suddenly change his lingo to say, I want cocaine during a conversation, she was not changing her normal course of business in dealing in these corrupt transactions to reflect what the government was doing in terms
of
pursuing a case.
Are you suggesting then we should analogize this to the cases where we let an experienced DEA agent to interpret code remarks?
I don't believe
that. Is this the equivalent situation?
It's similar, Your Honor, but I would say that it's not entirely the same. She was a one-on-one, you know, an actual participant in these conversations. And so under Federal Rule of Evidence 701, she's not an expert opining. She's actually a participant who has that required firsthand knowledge and the ability to talk about what she was perceiving in these conversations.
Well, we can just have her testimony. We don't have to have her say what she meant, right? I mean, she said, I said this, and then you ask her, what do you mean by that? Aren't we evolving and causing speculation on the interpretation of her testimony when we actually have her testimony?
Well, but what she testified about is when she made comments in recorded conversations, what she meant and what she was referring to. And in any conversation.
We have a recorded conversation, right?
We do, Your Honor. But in any conversation between two people, there will be references to things that make sense between those two individuals who were participants in the conversation, but that require further explanation in order for the jury to fully comprehend what's going on in that conversation. And that's the purpose of Rule 701 and what is encompassed by allowing this sort of testimony underneath that rule.
Well, we have a case where the jury, acquitted on 3 of the 5 accounts? I mean, this is not an overwhelming case. It may be sufficient. I'm not prejudging the outcome, but it's not an overwhelming case, so perhaps the 701 interpretation here could be a tilt. I don't know. I mean, she had a lot of latitude, I guess is what I'm saying, in interpreting the tapes.
Your Honor, it's correct that she was able to give her understanding of what was happening, but she was never opining on the defendant's mental state or his knowledge. She never crossed that line into the impermissible territory.
Yeah, but if we think it's so clear that the developer knew what she was saying, why couldn't the jury also be at least as sophisticated as this developer in understanding what the tapes are about?
Because the jury was not there in the conversations and did not have the history between the jury and Ms. Romasanta that Mr. Carrescu and Ms. Romasanta had. There's a lot of references that are really built into the fact that they had a prior dealing and had done a prior job together. I see that my time has expired, so if there's no further questions, I will thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you, Ms. Sindel. So, Mr. Herbert, your time expired. We're just going to have a minute if you'd like.
Thank you, Your Honors. Briefly, with response to the government's argument regarding my arguments, which seem to go towards the sufficiency of the evidence in this case, be clear, Your Honors, I am not asking you to reweigh the evidence necessarily. What I am saying is that when you look at the evidence and how thin and how veiled it is, there can be no question that the 404B character evidence played the critical role in the jury finding Mario Olivella guilty in this case. And clearly the 404B evidence that was admitted against Mario Olivella was not properly admitted in this case. As Your Honors are well aware, 404B evidence is limited. It has to be shown to go towards an individual's state of mind. Well, in this case, the evidence that was introduced against Mario Olivella regarding the 404B evidence in no way was inextricably intertwined with the case at issue. The fact of the matter is it dealt with Catherine Romasanta and Teal Scorte. None of those individuals had anything to do with the plumbing conspiracy. So the fact that those individuals were allowed to give evidence against them, it played no role in it. The bribe was between Mario Olivella, the alleged bribe, and Benny Garniana. There's no evidence to suggest that Benny Garniana knew anything about these other alleged bribes. So it's completely, it was improper. And the severance, the case should have been severed, and we should have been allowed to attack the credibility of Benny Garniana in this case because he was clearly the only person that could link Mario Olivella to a bribe. And quite frankly, Benny Garniana reversed his position and said that the evidence that was contained within the wiretaps, his statements were not necessarily true. And the government knew about that because he changed his plea and admitted that he was essentially lying about the bribe with Mario Olivella. And I would say for those reasons, there's no question that these convictions, I would ask, you know, respectfully that they be reversed or in the alternative that he be granted a new trial.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Goodrum.
Thank you.
Mr. Goodrum?
If I may just make 3 points. First, the argument that this was a minor mistake of Ms. Romasanta. This was their entire case. That the mistake was that when Dimitri was talking about the price per unit that he paid last time, he's talking about her fee, and they knew that he was talking about her fee. And she tells the jury that all the discussions about price per unit are discussions about the amount of bribe that he wants to pass.
Said about the references to the other guys.
Pardon me? Sir.
Reference to the other guys.
Certainly, Judge. And we're not standing here saying there wasn't evidence in the record that a reasonable trier fact could have convicted these guys. It's our position, and certainly our position at trial, was that he was inexperienced. He knew that there were fees and costs. He was the contractor on this. He was working long days. He's very frustrated during these conversations, and you can hear it. It's in the brief. You can hear him say, you know, please, just tell me what it's going to cost, and I'll pay your fees.
Mr. Goodman, is there anything in the record about his background? I know we talk about his inexperience. Let's say commanded a language as a native to the country. Do we have anything that
is an
an understanding his capacity of
English is not
the dialogue, so to speak.
He's an immigrant from Romania. He escaped communist Romania as a teenager. English is not his first language.
But he's been here some time.
Been here since he was 18 years old. The second point I wanted to make is the government claims that they conceded later that they didn't understand it because the documents were somehow confusing. This is nonsense. And even if it were true that they just understood it during the cross-examination that she had gotten the number wrong, they continue to elicit testimony directly from Ms. Ramasanta that the number of, when he's talking about price per unit, he's talking about bribe payments that he wants to pass. The government says, well, the jury still could have convicted even if we had told the truth, even if we had said, well, he was paying her a fee of this amount and he should have known that some part of that was going to be passed on. But they never advanced that theory. Their theory was that he directly knew, you can prove that he directly knew because she is telling the jury that those comments about price per unit, he's talking about the bribe that he wants to pass, and that was false testimony. The one last thing I wanted to just mention about the 701 is what we're not talking about is Ms. Ramasanta interpreting what she meant on the tapes. Certainly she was allowed to do that. What you'll see in the briefs, and it's laid out, more than a dozen times she says what Dumitru meant. So, for example, when he says we're on the same page, she says he meant that he wanted me to pay a bribe, illegal bribe, to obtain illegal dwelling units. This is the Wontok case. This court drew a line and said, you know, if informants are going to get up there and give their opinion, they can't talk about the ultimate issue, and that's exactly what she did. She said again and again, more than a dozen times, what he meant was he wanted to pass bribes for illegal dwelling units. There was nothing ambiguous about that. Thank you.
I don't understand that point. The most natural thing in the world to say, what did you understand? Not what did the person mean. What did you understand him to mean? That's perfectly appropriate testimony. You're asking the person about her understanding of what someone who's talking to her means, right?
And this court has approved that. For example, in the Estrada case, where it's helpful to the jury, and that's the second requirement, where the people have a relationship, they know each other, and where they're speaking in coded language, and then the jury doesn't understand.
Coded language. People who know each other, you know, they talk in a shorthand, and it's part of one's personal knowledge. It's not hearsay. It's not expert evidence or anything. Just to be able to understand what someone is saying to you. And if the person is saying something that is not automatically understood by strangers, the person can say, well, what I thought he meant was X. Now, that she can't say it was X. She can say, that's what I understood. I thought he meant this. I don't see anything wrong with such testimony.
Well, I think the point is that there was very little prior relationship. So the jury heard all the conversations just as Ms. Ramasanta, and the jury had just as much ability. And what this court said in Estrada is that it might be appropriate for her to say what he meant. in a case where there's coded language.
No, that's not right. Because when people talk to each other, they're not using code. But that doesn't mean that they're using the language in the same way that other people are, because people have all sorts of different ways of talking. Haven't you ever overheard a conversation between two people and it's totally unintelligible what they're talking about? They're using regular English words, but there's obviously a lot of assumptions that go into conversation. That's why it's when you eavesdrop on people, you don't really know what they're talking about. And so it would be perfectly, if you interrupted, yeah, listen to your fascinating conversation. But I couldn't understand. Could you explain what you understood that other person to be saying? There's nothing wrong with that.
I agree with you, Judge, and that's why under Rule 701A, there's a requirement that there be some prior, that the person have a basis for their knowledge. If there was a long-standing relationship between Ms. Romasanta and Mr.
Long-standing, there is a relationship.
There was no relationship. They were practically strangers. They had had one prior transaction a year ago where they maybe spoke on the phone twice.
Well, all right, so we're beginning to have a history of conversations. How do you know it's only twice?
That was the testimony was that she came in shortly before he got his permits in April.
Did she testify that there were only two conversations?
I don't think she testified to the number of conversations, but she testified that she came in at the very end, and she quoted him a fee. He paid the fee.
Okay, so thank you. You were appointed, were you
yes,
not?
Judge.
Okay, well, we thank you for your service on behalf of your client. Move on.